You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko kēsta tōku ingoa. No mai haere mai ki Te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire Wharahina Monday. I'm your host Kester and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Thomas. If I can, coming up on the show, I spoke to senior lecturer in urban planning, Dr. Alan Barman-Temori, about the new Auckland City deal and the differing opinions on Auckland's development. Thomas, what have you got for us today?
For our weekly catch-up with ACT Party's Simon Court, I asked about the Iran ceasefire, the United States blocking the Strait of Hormuz, and the Broadcasting Standards Authority. I also talked to ETU director Matt Danaher about a new survey of journalist union members which found some concerning trends. And I spoke to Te Kaihatu Māori for the PSA, Jack McDonald, about new proposed job cuts for the Ministry of Justice and Te Puni Kokiri.
He aha ofakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātohi mai, text in on 5395 or wai mai rānei. Give us a call in the studio on 309 3879. Kawa e warawara e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō. Hei pakehere rokiroki mārongi i te pai, tukutuku o ererangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM erakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more as always by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
Over the past week, the conflict in Iran has seen consistent U-turns as the United States continues to change its strategy in the war. On Wednesday morning, United States President Donald Trump threatened Iran, saying a civilization will die tonight, just hours before agreeing to a two-week ceasefire with Tehran. The ceasefire is now in doubt, however, as Israel has escalated its bombing campaign in Lebanon, killing hundreds since it was signed. And Trump announced this morning that the US will block the Strait of Hormuz after failed peace talks with Iran and Pakistan. Amidst all of this, New Zealand's Foreign Minister Winston Peters met with US Secretary of State Marco Rubio on the day of Trump's threats and wouldn't condemn the comments. Some New Zealanders are concerned by the country's limp response to these illegal threats and actions against Iran. Also this month, the ACT Party has continued to call for the abolition of the Broadcasting Standards Authority after it was announced that a complaint about online site The Platform and its host, Sean Plunkett, would be looked at by the authority. For our weekly catch-up with ACT Party's Simon Court, I asked him about the ceasefire in Iran, the US blocking the Strait of Hormuz, and the Broadcasting Standards Authority. This morning, US President Donald Trump has announced the United States will begin blocking the Strait of Hormuz. How important is freedom of peaceful navigation to New Zealand, and should we be concerned by this escalation?
Well, the US is trying to stop Iran from using that route to threaten world shipping or to charge for passage tolling. I mean, it's a modern form of piracy, what the Iranians are doing. And instead, the US intends to keep it open for traffic. That matters not just because the Hormuz is a regional waterway. It's actually a vital artery for global trade and energy, including for New Zealand, where, you know, we get a lot of petrochemical product, we get fertilizer, as well as crude oil that flows to refineries that supplies New Zealand. Look, New Zealand needs to keep backing efforts around de-escalation, diplomacy, because in the end it's only going to be solved at the negotiating table. But of course, you know, unless there is freedom of navigation, freedom of the seas, which New Zealand depends on, the situation as it currently stands with Iran blocking the strait is untenable.
You talked about the solution being about negotiating there. There was the ceasefire agreement agreed last week between the US, Israel and Iran, but it's been seen as very insecure, not very stable with this blocking now, but also Israel escalated their attacks on Lebanon. We've seen hundreds killed since the ceasefire has begun. Are these attacks unhelpful to reaching that peaceful resolution?
Well, I mean, it's become quite clear it's not so much ceasefire as a ceasefire. As you know, a pause in the US operations to give them time to negotiate with Iran. Look, what's happening in Israel, I understand the Israelis consider it to be a separate conflict. I mean, they've fought an existential war with the zombie hordes coming across their borders on October 7, Hamas, you know, October 7, 2023. It looks like what they've discovered in Lebanon is a similar plan, tunnels full of weapons and preparations being made to come across their northern border. So you can understand why the Israelis are, you know, rightly very, very concerned and want to make sure that that type of threat is controlled, if not eliminated. It's a really complex situation, and it's hard to judge from all the way over here in little old New Zealand exactly what the right course of action is. But you know, Iran's been playing this role as a state sponsor of terror since 1979. You know, this conflict that we've seen over the past couple of months is really, you know, just the latest chapter. And you know, what's gone on before, you know, the Iranians were behind the bombing of the U.S. Marine barracks in Beirut, which killed hundreds of U.S. soldiers. You know, they've been responsible for bombings and attacks around the world over many decades, which have killed thousands. So, you know, we need to keep this in perspective, and I think the most important thing New Zealand can do is to reinforce that in the end, only a lasting diplomatic solution is going to help the world.
On New Zealand's response there, Foreign Minister Winston Peters met with Marco Rubio just hours before US President Donald Trump threatened that a whole civilization will die tonight in regards to Iran. There's some concerns that New Zealand's response here hasn't been outspoken enough about the actions and threats against Iran that are against international law. Can you explain the positions in regards to this carelessness of international law the US has shown?
Well, look, I do follow US politics, and what I've heard many commentators over there say is, look, you've got to take Donald Trump seriously, not literally. If you look at his his social media posts, you'll see they can be pretty vitriolic. But let's be clear. Iran is a clear threat to its neighbours. Its behaviour by firing rockets and drones indiscriminately at residential areas in Israel, in Kuwait, in Bahrain, Saudi and Dubai, it's just obvious that they are a bad actor. So, you know, what Winston Peters was doing when visiting Marco Rubio, look, in an uncertain world, it's important New Zealand does actively engage with our key security and defence partners like the US. The meeting wasn't just about conflict around the world. It's actually about economic opportunities for New Zealand, including critical minerals, securing our energy and overall supply chain. And there's real interest in the US in working with New Zealand on everything from minerals, not just extraction and mining, but also processing here. And there's a really big opportunity for growth there, which New Zealand needs to be ready to take advantage of.
Yeah, about taking Donald Trump seriously there, he's also today threatened to specifically target Iran's water supply and power stations. I mean, I know you say we should be diplomatic, but surely New Zealand, as someone who stands up for international law, should maybe be saying something more.
Well, I think what New Zealand needs to do is focus what's important to New Zealand, which is making sure that we can secure energy, commodities that we absolutely rely on, such as fertilizer, petrochemicals, resins, all the things that go into manufacturing in New Zealand. We can't make things to sell to the world unless we can get the raw ingredients that we combine with our own natural resources here. So rather than pronouncing about other people's, particularly allies' actions when they are at war, and they are at war with a regime that has been screaming and chanting death to America since 1979, when they took over the US embassy in Tehran and kept hundreds hostage for over a year, threatened those people and treated them terribly. I mean, the US views this in a way I think it's hard to understand from New Zealand, and we should just be cognizant of that.
Right, moving on now to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. This month, ACT has revived calls to abolish the authority after it was announced a complaint about the online site the platform would be considered. Why is abolition here, rather than amending the legislation potentially, the ACT party's response?
Well, the BSA is starting to look less like a broadcasting regulator and more like a taxpayer-funded hall monitor for the internet. And that's what bureaucracies do when their original job disappears. They go looking for a new one. a law written for the 1980s television should not become a backdoor for regulating online speech. That's ACT's view. And if the BSA think the answer to irrelevance is regulating the internet, that tells you they've totally lost the plot. We've already got laws for online harm, like defamation and incitement. We do not need a state speech referee roaming around the internet telling people essentially what they think is acceptable speech and what isn't.
So if we got rid of the BSA, what controls would we then have over misinformation and discrimination on air? Would there be any alternative introduced?
Well, we already have laws for actual harm, like defamation and incitement. I mean, if you think something is misinformation, you know, the best answer to misinformation, if you consider that's what it is more information. That's why ACT supports free speech rather than speech policing by the likes of BSA.
What are your opinions on, is there not more nuance here in the debate? I mean, the BSA isn't going after, you know, all comments made online. The platform is very much acting as a broadcaster, just in an online context. Do you think that there's absolutely no world where the BSA should intervene when this broadcast is going out to thousands, millions of people?
Well, look, in the 1980s, when New Zealand was a very socially conservative country that had two television stations, both of which were owned by the state, having a broadcasting standards regulator where people could ring up and complain about something they'd heard on TV probably made sense. But in the world we live in now, where you and I could jump online, click on just about anything, content coming from any jurisdiction in the world, whether it's on YouTube or any other platform, and see live broadcasts. I mean, I can jump online now and watch live news and content from just about anywhere in the world. It makes no sense at all that the BSA, a 1980s organisation set up to police language and standards, you know, in a very conservative country nearly 50 years ago, is the right kind of organisation to be regulating broadcast on the internet. It's clearly not. I think we just need to go back to first principles. Now, the answer to bad speech is more good speech. That's one of ACT's principles. We believe in freedom of speech. And, you know, we need to have laws and enforce them when it comes to defamation and incitement to do harm. That would be exposition. That's all we need.
I know you're not prepared. I might just ask a quick question on the cyclone. Is that all right? So we've seen the cyclone come through the North Island yesterday. More of these, you know, once-in-a-lifetime weather events seem to be happening. Is there any potential policy change the government's going to take from this for preparation for future cyclone or events?
Well, I think what we've seen is New Zealanders take the warning about cyclone very seriously in terms of preparing themselves. That's what we want Kiwis to do. We want them to have 3 days' supply of food and water. That's the minimum. But in terms of additional government policy to get people ready for an event, we're doing a lot of work in emergency management in basically setting up systems that are better able to respond. In resource management law, one of the things that we're exploring through the process that I'm working on with Chris Bishop, you know, to reform and replace the RMA, is to provide more flexibility for councils and others to actually go and do things like get a digger into a river, clear debris out of it before the storm comes. At the moment, if you put an excavator into a river to start clearing material away, you could be prosecuted and fined and potentially even go to jail, even though you're doing the right thing for your community. So I think it's really important that we make sure that Kiwis have as much flexibility as possible to prepare for storms and not let bureaucracy and red tape get in the way.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court speaking to me about the ceasefire in Iran, the US blocking the Strait of Hormuz, and the Broadcasting Standards Authority.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
Thanks for all your texts. Lots of great stuff coming through on the text line. If you want to share your thoughts on that interview or any of the interviews on the show, text in 5395.
The Wire.
Last week, ETU Union released a survey it took of its members in the journalism sector. The results found a concerning lack of stability and sustainability in the industry, with many journalists struggling. Issues outlined in the report included more than half rating their employers' implementation of AI as bad or unethical, increasing pressure to cover multiple roles as less journalists are hired, and pay quickly falling behind comparable professions. To discuss the survey and potential crisis of journalism in New Zealand, I spoke to ETU Director Matt Danaher. Can you tell us a bit about this Etu journalism survey and give us a summary of some of its findings?
Yeah, absolutely. So we conducted this survey of our journalist members who work across the country for a number of different organisations, including all of the major ones. And basically, we asked the specific questions we asked because this is what we were already hearing anecdotally from people. So we wanted to actually establish how sort of widely felt and deeply felt these issues were. And what we've identified as an industry I don't think it's hyperbole to describe it as a kind of occupation that's in a bit of crisis, really. And we already know, of course, and there's a lot of conversation around declining trust in media from among the general public, but there's also a huge sort of declining trust in their ability to continue working in the industry among journalists themselves, as well as obviously a significant level of concern around the encroachment of AI or large language models on the work of journalists as well. And that's all rolled in with a massive reduction in the number of people working overall in the environment, and also the kind of mashing together of what were always seen as very different and equally valued in different ways skill sets, you know, around photographer, videographer, writer, social media expert, and so on. These are increasingly being sort of squashed together into one person. We're seeing salaries kind of stagnate in the sector, and we're seeing people wanting to leave, basically, and not seeing a future for themselves in the profession.
Talking about people wanting to leave, in that survey it found 60% of respondents said they could not see themselves as journalists in 10 years. How concerning is the shrinking of journalism as a profession in our current socio-political landscape?
Well, it should be really concerning to anyone who cares about democracy and accountability, because the reality is that without a strong, active, well-engaged, well-trained, committed journalism sector, how are we going to find out what's going on? How are we going to find out the truth about what our politicians are up to, what our big businesses are up to, you know, what criminals are up to, the reality, what law enforcement is up to? The reality is we are only aware of all of these things that are going on because of journalists telling us about them.
What are some of the wider reasons for this degradation of the industry? Can it be improved in any way?
Well, obviously, it's been a massive shift away from print towards online, and then a shift into, of course, in a reliance on social media and algorithms and the way that steers certain types of content to people, and the way in which it's really can be quite difficult for responsible journalism to break through in that. And it feels like, you know, the media organisations a few years ago, it felt like they did have some ideas. You know, we had that legislation passed around the ability for them to negotiate with social media providers around payment for stories, and that's happening. There's also been a shift towards actually being able to monetize online journalism, which is really important to ensure the sustainability of it. But it feels like that when it comes to AI, there's actually that's a real danger there, which I don't know if the media organisations really appreciate it. I think that there are people who employ journalists, don't really understand the value of the work that they're paying for, and think that AI can somehow replace journalists, or indeed editors for that matter. And that's a real risk, because we're seeing big increases. Everyone's talking about AI slop and things like that. The reality is, if you or I look at an article online and from an international news provider, and we see it's obviously AI written, we're actually really unlikely to look at it. And we're also, if we do look at it, we do read it, and we share those stories, we're likely to get criticised by other people who read it and see what it is. And then there's a question over how true the stories are, and it just, you know, further erodes trust in the media.
On that AI point, quite a large point it found in the survey was a worry of the implementation of AI, and specifically a concern about kind of, is it being put in ethically? What are some of the impacts, you talked about trust there, that careless use of AI could have in journalism as a whole?
Yeah, well, that's it. Trust is the number one thing, but also just quality. And then people's desire to read it goes away. I mean, if an AI has written an article, if somebody hasn't bothered to write an article or edit it properly, you know, they've just run it through an AI and got them to put it up, why should I bother reading it? That's a lot of the discourse you see out there, and that's perfectly understandable. And there's real dangers that you might have articles that are written by journalists, but actually are then corrected and edited by AI, and that can have the effect of course, removing facts
and replacing them with hallucinations, AI hallucinations, removing citations and replacing them with false, correct citations, and or there are no citations, they add in false citations. There's a huge amount of risk, and when you've got media organisations that need to produce more and more content with less and less people, there's less and less, there's more and more chance of that stuff sort of sneaking through and getting published, and then further damaging the reputation and also people's desire to consume that content. So there's all sorts of reasons why that's quite worrying. And it's not to say that AI can't play an important role in terms of helping people, say, with spelling and grammar and sentence structure and things like that. You know, there could be some quite good stuff that comes through, but it really does need really strong guardrails that ensure that not only journalists are protected as a profession, but also the media outlets are protecting their own reputations.
Another possible issue that's partially caused by AI is the lack of opportunities for young journalists nowadays. How concerning is this for the sustainability of the profession going forward?
Well, that's exactly it. And it's, you've already got a profession that is unpopular with a particularly vocal section of the population who, you know, can do all sorts of things and to put pressure on journalists to make it seem like an unappealing profession, including threatening people, following them to their homes and things like that, as we've seen in the recent past in this country. And then on top of that, you've got declining salaries, and you've got people working in the industry for many years who were earning, actually less than, $60,000 in some cases. You know, in the recent past, we've had journalists having to do Uber Eats deliveries to kind of pay the bills. And then we've got the AI as well further devaluing the journalism as an occupation. If you're a young student now who's interested in creating content and in finding out how things work and educating people on that, what is there to really draw you in?
That was ITU director Matt Danaher speaking to me about a new survey of journalist union members and the concerns it's found.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the beat.
If you're anything like the crew at 95BFM, you'll be fizzing for records all day. And B-card holders, get ready to bubble over, because we've got a special Southbound prize to give away. In celebration of Records Store Day, Southbound is giving away a $50 voucher. This voucher is redeemable in-store exclusively on Records Store Day. Listen to Breakfast all week for your chance to win. Records Store Day at Southbound Records, Saturday, April 18th at 132 Simon Street, Auckland Central.
Thick black mascara and little black curtains. Too little hold in my neck, bat was bitten. Black velvet capes with stylish bat wings. These are a few of my favourite things.
It's the sound of music, but not as you know it. The 95BFM Monday 1 to 4 with the Sinister Sister and Goth Mother Superior, Penny Black. Tune in to hear our dark diva spinning nothing but the unholy best from the Devil's Discotheque. Brought to you by Flying Nun Record Store, 202 Karangahape Road.
You know when you're looking at art and you're like, oh my god, I love that butterfly.
And your friend is like, what are you talking about? That's a cow.
And someone else is like, that's a self-portrait.
And the artist is like, it's actually a statement about cryptocurrency and its effect on Bulgarian farming communities in 1934.
And then someone says, I'll buy that painting of a tomato for $1 million.
Well, that's kind of what Various Artists is about.
Various Artists, for your all-encompassing art chat. Fridays, midday till 1, brought to you by actual art experts Sophia and Maya, only on 95BFM.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Wire. That was Aftermarket by Carrie's Fish.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
Auckland Council and the government have recently announced plans to cooperate with a new Auckland City deal. The deal concerns collaborations between council and central government over the next few decades, across issues such as Eden Park's ownership and operation, or investigations into a potential bed levy. Part of the plan and part of Auckland Council's recent disputes with the government has been housing planning. In February of this year, the minimum housing cap for Auckland was lowered to 1.6 million and was lowered again in March to 1.4 million. The drop came alongside complaints from many residents of central suburbs, such as Ponsonby, Mount Eden and Epsom, who say intensification would hurt the character of their neighbourhoods. On the other side of the debate are those who say intensification is necessary to ensure housing remains affordable, especially close to the CBD. To discuss the debate and what the Auckland City deal has for Auckland, I spoke to Senior Lecturer in Urban Planning, Dr. Alan Bamantemori. And so there's been a new Auckland City deal announced between Auckland Council and the government. What are the kinds of things urban planners were wanting to see in the deal, and how do those compare to some of the things that we actually saw out of it?
Yes, we actually observed a new deal, and I think this is something that we expect in planning. This is quite normal. We first have some assessments, we create a plan or suggest a plan change, like what we had planned 78 and then now plan change 120. So this is quite normal. We always try in planning, specifically in urban planning, we try to have feedback, we evaluate what we had, and then see if what we have developed is appropriate, if it is working properly in terms of infrastructure and hazard. So I think this new deal hopefully can help to create a kind of agreement between central government and Auckland Council to develop city in a better situation and more futuristic approach to urban development. This is what I see. And it is quite normal, all these revisions and recalibration of the what we decided previously. It is part of the process of planning. It's quite natural.
And we've seen previously this government having some disagreements with Auckland Council over housing policy in particular. Changes to PC 120 with the minimum housing capacity lowered first from 2 million down to 1.6 million and then again down to 1.4 million. What does that mean for the city, and what kind of attitudes are influencing this disagreement?
I think in terms of the disagreement, this is again quite normal for planning. I think this kind of conflicts between central governments and local governments are mostly related to the infrastructure capacity of the city for further development, what type of development we need, and also the contribution of urban development to GDP growth, to economic growth. So mainly the central governments, they see shortage in supply. So we want to supply more housing in the market. But in reality, in many cases, we don't have enough capacity to develop. These kind of conflicts is rooted to the capacity of infrastructure and also what we name sometimes as the politics of land use planning, conflictual interest over the places or further development in terms of greenfield development or brownfield development, both of them. And I think this type of communication between government and local governments, central governments and local governments are quite helpful to deal with this kind of conflict in terms of urban development or ownership or what type of land use we require in specific places and even what type of urban development is more important for our economic growth and also economic efficiency.
And it seems like the debate over how housing developments in Auckland should continue has two key sides, I guess. On one side, there's a lot of the younger generation, you know, students, some members of council, some urban planners as well, talking about intensification and the importance of, you know, building apartments and similar stuff closer to the city to ensure that people can access their workplaces, their universities, all that sort of stuff. And then on the other side, there's these people with these large properties in these central suburbs, you know, Mount Eden, Ponsonby, Parnell, Epsom, saying that they don't want the special character of their suburbs destroyed. What do you make of that debate? And the government seems to have favoured one side in particular. What do you make of that decision as well?
This is really interesting. This is part of the actually courses that we need to cover in the courses, in the urban planning courses, specifically, for example, in urban economics. Yes, we have always this kind of conflicts, and we need futuristic approach to urban development. We need intensification. But from the other hand, we have some kind of I would frame it as a kind of value for the heritage neighborhood, or what we need to preserve as heritage for the future. So it seems they are kind of conflicts of interest over the future, the direction of future urban development. But this is the role of planning. We need to talk with both sides. It needs modeling, calculations, and see how we can really put these kind of conflictual interests together and plan for future urban development. And we cannot say any of them is, any side is wrong, but we need to plan for these type of conflicts. We have different mechanisms and different tools in planning. How we can compensate for those people who are worse off from urban development, and how we can preserve heritage at the same time allocate more kind of intensification at the proper appropriate places, as we've seen in the new plan change, closer to the transportation hub, or in the places with enough capacities. And also we need to consider hazard as well. And putting all these things together is not really easy. That's why having more kind of deal agreements between different parties will be really helpful.
And it almost seems like two different, I guess, sources for these ideologies as well, right? The intensification model, looking at maybe some of the big European cities, whereas the idea that households should have large sections, large backyards, large driveways, seems to be a very American idea. Do these ideas, you know, how do these interact, and how do you think they'll interact going forward as we build Auckland to be a city for the future?
This is really good, interesting, good question. Yes, the point is that we are not similar to the European cities with that level of density that we observe in the European cities and urban development in European cities. And we are not also close to the American cities. We have our own type of development. But the reality is that we need intensification at some places. That's why I think this new plan change can be helpful to make sure we evaluate every case or every step of development. Yes, there's a trade-off. We need to spend more time sometimes. We need to be more cautious about different types of urban development. But case by case, it is better to consider all the different type, kind of angles and dimensions of development, and then make sure we are doing the right things. So I think we can have our own style of urban development that is not similar to American cities with those industrialization and big companies, heavy industries at some places. And we are not like European countries with high density areas and at many points overcrowded places. So we have this chance and this capacity to develop what is really deserved for the New Zealand context and appropriate for our context.
There's been a lot of talk from the government promoting increased greenfield developments. What's your take on that, I guess, and as they compare to brownfield developments as well?
We know greenfield development always they have greater contribution to economic growth. But brownfield development is more about social dimension of urban development and how we can bring back some of the underused or undervalued lands to the economic growth and GDP growth of the city. So always greenfield development are easier and faster and a great contribution to GDP growth, economic growth. But brownfield development are more difficult, challenging. We need to upgrade the capacity of infrastructure, but normally the contribution is slower and the contribution to social dimension is more in-depth in comparison to greenfield development. This is something that probably we need to rethink about greenfield development as well.
That was Senior Lecturer in Urban Planning at the University of Auckland, Dr. Alan Bamundamori, speaking to me about the Auckland City Deal and housing intensification debates in the city. We'll be right back after this short break. This is Nothing Would Change by the Linda Lindas.
Running was a game. It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Last week, two new propositions for job cuts in the Ministry of Justice and Te Puni Kokiri were announced, which would get rid of a combined 53 jobs. A large portion of the proposed jobs, which would be slashed, were roles which help advise Māori and Crown relations, raising worries that government won't be reaching its treaty obligations. The entire inquiry team who deal with Waitangi Tribunal inquiries at the Ministry of Justice would be let go, and cuts at Te Puni Kokiri would mean 21% of the workforce will have been lost under this government. To discuss these job cuts and their impact on Māori, I spoke to Te Kai Hotu Māori for the PSA, Jack McDonald. Can you give some background, not only about these most recent proposed job cuts at the Ministry of Justice and Te Puni Kokiri, but cuts to Māori services in general under this government?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've seen over the last 2 years since the coalition government took office a hollowing out of Māori capability and Te Tiriti capability across the public service and the state sector as well. So this is part of their extreme anti-Māori agenda, and we saw when they first take office, they just established the Māori Health Authority, Te Aka Whai Ora, and they started undertaking a program of cutting roles across the public services and teams that have a focus on Māori capability. So this has affected a wide range of agencies, including the Ministry of Education, the Ministry of Health, Pharmac, Kāinga Ora, Inland Revenue, and Te Puni Kokiri. And so just last week it was revealed that this is the third round of job cuts at Te Puni Kokiri, which will mean that over 20% of their workforce have been cut. Te Puni Kokiri do incredibly important work as the lead agency on kaupapa Māori and Māori Crown relations. So this is going to have a devastating impact on the Crown's ability to meet its treaty obligations. And the same week, we also had 27 jobs go at the Ministry of Justice, 26 rather, cutting significant amounts of staff from the Aotearoa team, which deal with Māori Crown relations, and the entire inquiries team. And the inquiries team lead the Ministry of Justice response to Waitangi Tribunal claims. So, yeah, it's a very grim picture that we're seeing now across the public service.
Can you go into what a big impact, you know, having that entire inquiry team being cut is going to have potentially?
Yeah, it's really concerning, and we're asking questions as to what the ministry is going to do to ensure that that work is still being done, because often in these cases, when roles or teams are cut, the work is just, you know, pushed on to other staff who are already stretched and already have huge workloads. And so that, of course, then increases the risk of burnout and work-related stress. So it's a real concern, and, you know, there's no doubt that that work still needs to be done. So yeah, that's something that we're challenging the ministry to front up and provide answers on.
The government's claim these cuts are to meet spending reductions and balance accounts. We've seen public services cut all round, but how targeted do these continued funding slashes feel specifically to Māori?
So the government has, of course, been running that line since they first started, you know, gutting the public service. But in reality, this is making a very minor impact in terms of government finances, and the cuts that are being made are all to service their tax cuts for the rich and for landlords, which they brought in their first budget. And so we're still dealing with the consequences of those reckless tax cuts. And at the end of the day, the government spending decisions are all about priorities. And what is the impact of these cuts is going to mean that New Zealanders who access public services are going to have a much more difficult experience in trying to get those services. And when it comes to Māori, who have traditionally been severely underserved by the state, this is going to have a disproportionate impact on them. And, you know, I think about over the last few decades, we've had slow and often flawed but steady improvement in the way that the state does deliver services to Māori, growing recognition, the need to right historical wrongs. These cuts are really going to undermine that, and this government is really turning its back on those decades of progress and saying, actually, we don't think there is a role for the state in delivering targeted by Māori for Māori programs to Māori communities, and that's deeply concerning.
Is it especially worrying that we're seeing these cuts in the justice system, where we know the criminal justice system has had a historical disproportionate impact on Māori?
Absolutely. You know, there's there's huge amounts of evidence and research that Māori are disproportionately targeted at every level of the justice system, right from, you know, being stopped and searched, to being arrested, to being charged and prosecuted, to being sentenced and disproportionately imprisoned for the same crimes that non-Māori commit. So there has been a growing understanding and acknowledgement of that in government over the last few years. And so the work to address those disparities that the Ministry of Justice was undertaking alongside Māori is going to be severely impacted by these cuts, because the team that is losing many of these roles, the Aotearoa team, is essentially the Māori Crown Relations team in the Ministry of Justice, and so it's their responsibility to work alongside Māori organisations, whānau, hapū and iwi, to look at how we reduce these disparities. So that is something that I'm deeply worried about with these cuts.
And you touched on it a bit before, but can you go a bit more into how that such a large decrease in staffing levels will impact both the staff left unemployed and those who are still there and now having to deal with an increased workload?
Yeah, so obviously now is an incredibly difficult time in the job market, and, you know, we've seen rising unemployment across the economy, which this government has no plan to deal with. So people are losing their jobs and having extreme difficulty finding a new job, and that's just meaning that more people are going to be under extreme financial pressure at a time when no one can afford, you know, basic necessities. And, you know, we're seeing obviously fuel prices go through the roof, but the flow-on effects of those fuel shocks are felt across the economy and across prices. So now's the worst time to be fired, and as you say, there's also that impact on staff who are going to have to pick up the work of their colleagues. And, you know, we know that work-related stress has a huge impact on mental health and on the health and safety of workers. And, you know, government has a responsibility under the Health and Safety Act to not be putting undue mental stress onto their workforces. So it's hard to see how that's not going to happen with these increasing job cuts.
That was Te Kai Hatu Māori for the PSA, Jack McDonald, speaking to me about new proposed job cuts to the Ministry of Justice and Te Puni Kōkiri.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rahina Monday. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today, the ACT Party's Simon Court, Air 2 Director Matt Danaher, Senior Lecturer in Urban Planning at the University of Auckland, Dr. Alan Bamantamori, and Te Kai Hatu Māori for the PSA, Jack McDonald. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongoana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1-4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.